I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
If you're tired of spending money on trail cameras you use as tools only to find out they're built like freaking toys, or you've struggled with unreliable, not so dependable cameras or experienced customer service that flat out disappointed you, I've been there. Those problems literally birthed Exodus 8 years ago when they shipped their first camera. Exodus had a clear desire to not only build elite products that enabled you to set it and forget it all season long, but also to back them like no other company was willing to, with an unmatched level of customer service and support. See for yourself why Exodus has over 15,000 satisfied customers. They've quickly become known for their 5-year no BS warranty, quality cameras, and best-in-class customer service. You heard that right. Exodus believes in their products so much, every single camera is backed by a 5-year warranty that includes theft and accidental damage coverage. Each camera is checked for quality control standards before it leaves the warehouse. If they wouldn't use it, you don't get it. Exodus is so confident you'll love your new Exodus camera, they're offering you, the listener of this show, 15% off your next order today. Just use code BTE. If you don't love it, get your money refunded in the first 30 days and just send her back. Exodus really has two excellent cell cam options for all budgets, and they start at just $179. Plus, you're 15% off there. You use the code BTE. They have competitive data plans that allows you to purchase a plan and use the data as you see fit. They want you to be in control. There's no annual commitment and no limit on how many cameras you can run on one plan. You can share cameras with friends, no charge, which makes the Exodus lineup a great option for hunting clubs and leases. There are no additional fees for HD photo requests. That's pretty nice. No additional fees for video uploads. And all cameras share data on a single data plan for easy management. See for yourself why so many have made the switch to Exodus and experienced the Exodus difference. Use code BTE to get 15% off your next order today. Now let's talk about Osseo Gear. It's a great option for whitetail hunters. They develop a premium line of bow hunting gear that will rival any other clothing on the market in quality. Plus, you got a lifetime warranty on anything you buy from Osseo, which is pretty nice. They have a super unique camo pattern and great technology in their garments to keep you comfortable in the stand. So visit asiogear.com, get you some premium hunting clothing. Gotta talk to you about Stealth Outdoors, makers of Stealth Strips. Stealth Strips really are a product that any hunter, whether you're a weekend warrior or a guy that hunts almost every day, really needs to take advantage of. Stuff absolutely deadens your gear to make it essentially noise-free. If you haven't checked out Stealth Strips yet, stop buying all the other crappy alternatives like the hockey tape and any other stuff you're trying to use to silence your gear. Get the good stuff. Get Stealth Strips. Visit stealthoutdoors.com. Pick you up some Stealth Strips. All my partners are linked in the description below. Go check them out. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Joe, this is actually my second show tonight.
Oh, my God. You're burnt out, buddy. You don't have any voice left.
So I usually, the channel has members. And I usually just before I get on with the guest of the week, I'll go on with my members and just we'll have chit chat back and forth about whatever. Well, I accidentally didn't put the settings right, and I just put it live onto YouTube. So I got on here. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of people on for a members only one. And I'm like, oh no, this is everybody, not just the members. So I had a dual live stream tonight.
A technical glitch.
Josh doing too many things at once whenever he scheduled the the members only live stream is what it was, but that's all right. It was still fun. We chit chatted. We usually talk about like conspiracies and whatnot on the members only stream. We don't always talk about deer hunting, but
they're fun. I understand, man. There's a bunch of conspiracies that are coming true.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what we talk about. So anyway, how are things going, Joe? You had a heck of a
season. They're going good, man. You know, we're starting to get into the trade show circuit now, and that's kind of our focus company wise and then personal wise. You know, this time of year, the new bows, you know, have come out, new broadheads, new eras, sights, you know, all that stuff that I love to tinker with and mess with to see if I can do anything to make the system a little bit better. But so, yeah, that's what we're doing right now.
What's the system this year,
man?
What's on your radar?
Yeah. I tell you, you know, I've been a Matthews guy for years and years. I shot Hoyt. And I'll tell you one thing that I have found probably in the last 3 years of doing the testing, the bows are so close now. I mean, with everything, you know, with speed, quietness, how much they weigh, the draw cycles are a little bit different in each one of them. And that becomes kind of a personal preference, muscle memory type thing. But I tell you, the two that I have really liked the last 2 years are that Prime. And I like the I still like the Matthews because I've just shot it so long. My muscle memory is used to that draw curve. I've not had a chance yet to shoot that lift. I'm looking forward to shooting that new lift and then the new Prime as well. So I don't know. Jury's still out bow wise.
Yeah, I my very first like real bow, I had like a high country bow was my first bow, I don't know exactly if this you're supposed to do this. I'm sure you're not supposed to do this, but they didn't make very many youth bows when I was younger. Like that wasn't really a thing. So the bow shop they went to the hardware store and got longer bolts for my limbs that goes in my pockets so I could take them out farther. And that was my first bow was a high country that had extended bolt limbs. Anyway.
Yeah, I bet that was safe for the limbs.
Yeah, I don't. It was fine. It never hurt. Never hurt anything, but or never blew up on me. It did. The string would pop off a lot, which that may have something to do with it. Yeah. But I can remember it happened twice. That string popping off when I was deer hunting.
Ooh,
I'd pull it back to just practice for a second. It'd pop off. But the first good bow I got was a Hoyt, and I shot a Hoyt till just a few years ago. I probably shot a Hoyt for 20 years, all different flavors of them, but I always had a Hoyt and it was the draw cycle. I loved that draw cycle of the Hoyt and I loved the grip.
Yeah.
Like I'd pick up a Matthews and I'd be like, I can't even hold this thing. Like this thing feels so horrible to me just in the grip.
Go ahead.
Yeah. That's crazy. Now it's like, you almost just want to pick up a bow and just see which one feels the best, because it's, you know, the performance is close, like you said.
They are. I mean, we do nerdy stuff. You know, we'll get a decibel reader out and shoot the arrow at like 70 yards so it doesn't get up the impact of the target. So you can hear exactly, you get a reading of how loud the bow is. And then we've got at archery shot, we've got a big chronograph, a really good one. And I mean, they're all within a few feet of seconds of each other, and then the noise factor, and it's like you say, man, it's almost, it'd be better if you went in with a blindfold on,
yeah,
you know, into the archery shop and just, you know, had four or five of them rigged up and just draw them and shoot them and see what feels the best to you, and whatever that name brand is, you know, roll out and go with that.
Yeah. What broadhead you shoot this year?
So Tri-Pan, can't get away from that. And but I will say, and you know, not sponsored anything by these guys, but I went to the ATA show and G5 has a new Tri-Pan looking head. I guess the two things, if I had to criticize the Tri-Pan, it was the blade sharpness and the ferrule, even though it was a titanium ferrule, that hypodermic point would sometimes if it hit scapula or you know, dead center rib, the point and ferrule could bend a little bit. And what G5 did is they beefed up the ferrule, beefed up the tip, and then they put those Lutz blades, those real sharp German blades on there. Man, I was like a little kid at a candy store. I was like, when can I get these? Because I got a couple trips coming up later this summer in spring. And I was like, man, I need to go shoot some stuff. And they're like, well, they won't be ready till May. But that head, that for mechanical guys, man, I mean, their Mega Meat is a really popular head. I think it's actually taken over the number one selling mechanical of any broadhead now. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's my understanding. So a lot of guys like that. But I think with the two blade, you get better penetration and it's still a big 2-inch cut. And I think that's going to be the bee's knees.
Yeah. I may give that thing a try next year then. Cause man, I shot the dead meat this year, which is their 1.5-inch cut. And I loved it. Like both deer I shot with them died 30 yards from where I shot them.
Those blades are so sharp.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, now I didn't, you know, they're perfect shots and I'm not saying that any other broadhead would have done the same thing, but I was happy with them. So that was the first year I've shot mechanicals in a little while. I shot the, I've shot a bunch of stuff with Rage, but then I had the Tekkens. I don't know if you remember those.
Oh yeah.
I shot stuff with Tekkens too, back in the day. Shot my very first year with a punch cutter. You remember those?
I do not remember those.
Oh, you don't?
Nuh-uh.
Man, they were like a mechanical from back in the 90s, and my dad had them, and my dad was, he's always shot mechanicals, even back then, and yeah, it was like the tip, well, it was like this pencil, it was the tip was like plunger, and the blades were inside of the ferrule, and when you hit that plunger, the blades would pop out.
Okay, like a piston system.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, I think Rocket maybe makes one like that. This called Meat Seeker. I think there was one called Meat Seeker that was like that. It was piston driven, but the blades were held together by a rubber band. I had a buddy that really liked those. And I guess the original one I shot, which was not a great head, was the Jackhammer. I can't remember who made that, but that was way back in the 90s.
Yeah, my dad always shot mechanicals. My cousin shot muzzies. And I was 11. I was 11 years old when this was happening. And I had that High Country bow. And I got to my cousin's. He's going to take me hunting with it for the first time. And he saw that. And he goes, dude, he goes, what are they? He didn't know what they were. I don't know if he'd never seen mechanicals. You know, back then in the late 90s, like you didn't have the internet to.
Oh, right.
Anyways, he cut the rubber bands you're talking about, he cut them off all my arrows, and I hunted with a deployed expandable. That's what I shot my first deer with,
and it flew okay. Flew good.
Well,
enough.
I'm not gonna say that, but I got lucky.
Understand.
I missed. It was a doe fawn, is what it was, and I mean, not to get gruesome, but like. I missed her the first time, and if she was a fawn, she didn't do anything. And then I hit her in the hind quarters the second shot, and then got down and finished her. But so I'm not going to tell you that they were flying good.
That's hilarious.
But it's a crazy story now. What arrows are you shooting? Not to make this a bow and arrow.
No. So I shoot the Victory Rip TKOs.
Mm-hmm.
Really like that. It's a 204 diameter, so it's a not a micro, but it's a little bit above a micro shaft. It's a little bit bigger than those super micro shafts, and they just, man, we did a, this was probably 3 or 4 years ago, we did a pretty weird test. We ordered different sets of arrows from like 5 different states, so we would get different batches in and that's my OCD kicking in. Instead of going to the pro shop and getting 3 packs, you know, I'd order a pack from Alabama, a pack from Pennsylvania, a pack from Kansas, whatever. And we got them all in, and then we just did – and it's not dynamic spine testing, but just on a spine tester to test the spine, to test the straightness, and really surprising at how superior in that particular test – that the Victory arrows were. And I actually talked to the guys at Victory that year at the ATA, and they said that their apparently owned by Shimano, and Shimano makes, and I'm not going to say all of it, and this could have changed, but they make the majority of the carbon fiber that goes into arrows, and they sell it to different arrow makers, and they hold back, you know, some of the really good tolerant stuff. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it sure made sense. But
yeah,
I would argue that point too, if that was, you know, my arrow company. But anyway, long story short, I've had real good luck with them. They're very tough and fly great, and the tolerances have been good.
I've heard good things about Victory. That's one of the arrows I've never shot though. But yeah, if I was Shimano, they probably tell every single arrow manufacturer the same thing.
Of course.
But right. It sounds good though.
Oh, it sounds great.
Yeah. You been shooting your trad bow any?
Embarrassingly enough, I have not. Oh. I told you about my conversation with Bobby Worthington. Did I tell you about
that? No, I don't think you did.
So, I got into it heavy. You know, I was shooting all the time. I think I even sent you some videos and said, what am I doing wrong here? Does this look okay? And you gave me some pointers. Well, Bobby and I were somewhere or talking on the phone, and, you know, he's an 8-time world champion traditional shooter, you know, not national, but world. And I said, Bobby, you know, why aren't you shooting with traditional? And he said, without missing a beat, he said, because I'm not a good enough shot. He's an 8-time world champion. And I said, what am I doing here? You know, I like to hit what I'm aiming at, but man, one of these days I am going to get into it. And you know, I probably won't go over full time, but the thing about our swamp is we've got a lot of deer, we get a lot of deer tags, and we got a ton of hogs.
Yeah.
So especially this time of year, you know, I can get in there and shoot at some hogs and stuff like that. So it's something I definitely want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you should. I mean, yeah, Bobby's right. It's hard to be accurate with them, but there's guys that just stack animals up with them, man.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, it's I have another level of respect for the guys that, I mean, do it, you know.
Well, heck, you've done it. You've shot a bunch of stuff with
them. Yeah, but not like some people. The guys that do it full time and get it done every year, it's just like, man. My buddy Alan, who I'm sure people are tired of me bringing up Alan on this podcast, but he's hunted in 47 of the 50 states and has killed a big game animal in all 47 of them with a longbow.
Golly. Yeah. I bet he shoots every day too, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's just one of those guys that like for example, he had to go hunt Hawaii. You know, that was a state that he wanted to go hunt, and they got those axis deer out there. And he just like, it almost seems like something impossible. Like, I'm going to take a longbow out to Hawaii and go hunt on some public or whatever it's out there. I don't know if it's public or.
Yeah, it is. It's public.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people have a hard time killing them with compounds out there because they're real cagey animals, aren't they?
They are very cagey.
And Alan's like, I don't really know much about it. You know, he's never hunted them out there in Hawaii, and he flew out there. Actually, his wife had a work trip out there, so he just put his longbow in a suitcase and went out there with him and just went on some public land, and he got one, and he brought it into he just killed it, you know, brought it in the processors, and they're like, you killed that thing with that longbow? And they're like, yeah. They're like, that's the one of the biggest ones we've seen this year. And like, he's just like, eh. He's just one of those guys, you know.
Straight up killer.
Yeah, just no matter what, he gets it done with the longbow. He killed like a 160 on whitetail this year with it here in Indiana. Just one of those guys, man.
That's awesome.
Kind of a elusive guy almost. Just like, I don't know, just the way he lives in general is he's just kind of an elusive guy. So I think it wears off on the hunting side of it too. But anyways, you how many bucks did you kill this year?
Man, I shot 6 this year. I shot one here at home, shot one in Kentucky, one in Texas, one in Kansas, and 2 in Mexico.
I forgot about the Kentucky one.
Yep. Shot that end of October, very first of November, right around Halloween. We got a little cold front end, and got that guy.
How many? What's the most you've killed in a year? How many bucks?
I killed eight 2 years ago. Shot eight. Yeah, I had a good season here at home. I killed three at home, and I think I killed maybe two in Texas or something like that. So that was five, and then hit the Midwest circuit.
Yeah, that's crazy. Do you know how many whitetails you've killed now? Like buck, nice bucks.
Ooh, man, I don't. I couldn't guess.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I want to talk to you about. Like, and I just said that joke because I knew you've killed a plethora of them. And you're one of the guys that, like, whenever you start talking about whitetails, I listen. I listened to some other podcasts you were on today, just kind of prepping for this. And Exodus, I got real excited because one of my kind of goals in life, and I don't know if I'll ever reach them, but is I'd like to kill a whitetail in all the states that have whitetails. But they got a video of you, and the title is like hunting every state. I don't know what it is. It's like hunting every state that has a whitetail in it. But then I listened to the podcast, and I don't know if you've actually hunted every state that has whitetail.
No.
Okay. No. So it must have been just a clickbaity thing. But I saw that. I'm like, oh, Joe has done what I want to do.
No, I haven't done that. I mean, I've hit a bunch of them, and
yeah,
the main ones. Montana's kind of a different one, being from South Carolina, but just really the main ones, a lot of them in the South and that sort of thing, but never like up in Maine or even Pennsylvania or Michigan. No, I have shot one buck in Michigan, but that was years ago.
Yeah. As is South Carolina, me and I was talking to Rendell today, and he was talking about how you're such a whitetail fanatic and you still live in South Carolina. Is that just home to you? Is that why?
It is. It is home, and they're real cagey here, man. They like the property. I've got permission to hunt on one big farm that a buddy of mine owns, and then I'm in a hunt club on another one, and it makes up about 3,200 acres, and it's private, and so everybody says, oh my God, you've got it made, right? Well, at any one time, 40 people can be hunting on this 3,200 acres, and $5 a year, rifles starting August 15th, going until January 1st, and you can feed feeders and corn piles everywhere. So it is tough for a bow hunter, and you learn how to, get around the rifle hunters and kind of use them, because we don't really have funnels. And that's something I've really gotten into the last couple of years, was especially in the Midwest, is really identifying a real funnel. You hear that word a lot, funnel.
Yeah.
But a lot of folks, including myself, didn't really have a full grasp of what that is and how important that is. And so in South Carolina, because it's all flat, swamp, hardwood, cut over country, there's not a lot of, natural funnels, because they can really bed about anywhere and travel about anywhere. And there's food everywhere. We don't get the brutal winter that kills off all the food. There's browse and those cutovers. So it's really challenging. If we shoot 125, that actually makes our state book. If you shoot 125 inch deer, rifle or bow, that makes the state book. And I think we have four or five net Boone and Crockett's that have ever come out of South Carolina. So I get it. We don't have a bunch of big deer here, but man, you shoot a 4.5, 5.5 year old, one of these swamp bucks that lives in that Congaree River Basin, that's been around and seen a few things. It's rewarding. And so I look at it as relative to where I'm hunting. I will absolutely whack a 120 incher here in South Carolina if he comes by, and that's not a deer that I would get my bow up off the hanger in say Kansas, because not that there's anything wrong with guys in Kansas shooting 120 inch deer if that's what they want to do. I just know the potential out there is for world class stuff.
Yeah, and that's what I like. That says a lot about you, because like, you're just passionate about deer hunting.
I love it, man. I'm eating up with it, and just, it's just constant. It is constant, which is kind of drives my wife crazy. But we started dating when I was 18 years, but she was 18, I was 19, and we've been together. We've been married for 24 years, and dated. So she's very accustomed to the life. And if I'm around the house more than 2 weeks, she starts getting antsy and is like, you need to find somewhere to go.
Get
out of here, go hunt something.
Yeah. And I mean, Joe, you've been like, you loved it so much. You've made a great career out of it too, out of hunting. And not what made you get into the, and if people, we talked about this a little bit, I think, in the past, but you were into like the Africa stuff, and you were like an elk guide for a little bit, right?
Yeah. That was my real goal, was really when I was 12, I played baseball all through college and tore my shoulder up my last year of college. And that was my number one goal, was to try to make that a career, and that didn't happen. And number two was, I wanted to go, even when I was 12 years old, my dad bought these Peter Hathaway Capstick safari videos, and I watched those things till the tapes burn out. And I wanted to go to Africa and be a PH, a professional hunter. That's what I wanted to do. And I actually did do that. I went and did that for 7 years. And then Natalie and I had Jack, our son, and, you know, I couldn't be gone for 3 months at a time. So then I kind of started the hunt brokerage business. I started a business called Sporting Adventures, and we just started being like a travel agent for African hunting, Argentina hunting. And then I started doing a little bit of guiding out in Oregon, Ironside, Oregon, which is really, it's close to Boise. We would fly into Boise and drive right across the Idaho border into Oregon. And there's elk and mule deer on there, and had a lot of fun doing that for a couple of years. And yeah, that's kind of how we got going.
Did you have the whitetail addiction whenever you were doing that stuff, or was
one hundred percent. My dad was a savage. I mean, he had the 11th biggest whitetail killed in the state. And I've told this story, and I probably told it on the last one, but man, I can remember waking up when I was like just out of diapers and being in a sleeping bag and pulling my head up and looking, and I was in the middle of the woods. You know, I'd been asleep, and a piece of candy would hit me in the top of the head.
Yeah.
And I'd look up, and my dad was up in a tree with his rifle. I mean, he took me forever. And then when I got to be 12, you know, he was a woodsman, and he took me all through those swamps and acorns, you know, muscadines, edges, browse. I mean, that was his game. He was way ahead of his time, and just a heck of a hunter. So I was very, very fortunate to have him as a dad, and I actually had lunch with him today. And of course we were talking about deer hunting.
There you go.
Yeah.
You guys always have something to talk about.
No doubt.
Yep. Okay. Let's start talking a little bit about tactics now.
Sure.
Cause you clearly have something figured out, Joe. What do you think is like the most important characteristic of a guy that is killing big bucks consistently, like you are, and a lot of hunters throughout the country now?
I think there's a couple things that are synonymous with all the guys that do it at a high level. I think number one is their discipline. Number two, they pay attention to detail, like fine detail, like almost an obsession of detail. I think they have an uncanny work ethic. I think they will work and work and work and work at it. And then I think a lot of them, as much as some of them have egos, they are very open-minded and wanting knowledge. You know, they're able to check their ego. And when they're around somebody that killed a big deer on purpose, you know, not just a lucky hunt or, right, you know, something like that, but they killed one on purpose that they had some history with, and they figured him out, man, they will ask every single question about that hunt and about how it went down. And they'll take little pearls of wisdom from all of that stuff and put it into their craft and mold it into their system of hunting. So I think those are the things that really take a good hunter to be a really great hunter. That's my opinion and what I have seen. And I've been fortunate to be around some of the old time. You can't say Don Higgins is an old timer, but you know, a guy that's shot three, you know, 200 inch deer, and then, you know, around Bobby Worthington and you know, seeing what he's done and his tactics and on public land and big woods and hunted down the biggest buck in there and killed him. And I've been able to learn from those guys, and I try to be a sponge around them. When you've got a buck that you killed on purpose, you know, I want to know every little detail about that to try and pull something away that's eye opening. And you hear, you see it with all the guys. You know, I've watched Andre have questions with guys, and Adam Hayes have talks with guys, and these are big buck killers. And they listen to what guys say. And so I think that's having the open mind and being able to check the ego is an important factor.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be around some of these people too. And it is surprising like how certain certain times they'll perk up and just all of a sudden they're the listener instead of the one asking the, or getting the questions asked to them, you know. Can we like walk through one of the bucks you shot this year? Just, I guess, one that you think we would learn the most from or that you thought was unique, and maybe just walk through the tactics you used to kill it.
Yeah, I guess the Kansas buck, it was a 160-inch 9-point, is a nice buck. Went to Kansas, and I had a farm that I was going to hunt, and there was a bigger deer in there, but there was no consistency, and there was no real funnel. There was a creek bed, but where the creek was the property line, and I couldn't get to where I needed to go to kind of spend some time on this buck. I had to hunt the very edge of it. And after figuring that out, you know, this was a piece I'd never hunted. My buddy had a picture of the deer and said, have at it. And so I went in there and I said, man, this isn't going to work. You know, is there some other property we can go to? And he sent me some. So I picked one that had a river that went on the, not the middle, but maybe a third of the property. And then it really had two pinch points with fields. And I said, yeah, this looks good. And there had been a picture of this deer on this property, the 9-point. And so what I did is I think you can get away with it. I think one time is I went in and just blew it up. I walked the river, I walked everything. And then I found the spot, and it was a bluff that went down to the river, and our access could be inside that river because it wasn't very deep. And we're going to have a video of this entire hunt because Lucas got drone footage of how we accessed it. But we could come in from the river and then climb that bluff, and there was a tree right there on the – that's a funny story in itself, but there was a tree right on the bluff, and if we had a north wind – it was bulletproof. There was no way for a deer to get behind us. And then probably 80 yards in front of us was a couple blowdowns off of a field edge. And there were literally five trails in different areas that all came to that pinch. And it was perfect. And we found it in about 2 hours of walking in there. And I said, if we have a north wind, we're going to kill that buck. You know, it was about November 7th, the rut was starting, and we were just going to rot in that tree. And so the first, we went in and hung in, after we scouted, went back, took a shower, went in, walked down the river through the access, climbed the bluff there, hung the stand in that tree. And the trees, just to go off tangent for a second, but there was a blowdown in the top of it. And so it wasn't rotten, but there was a blowdown in it. And Lucas, who was filming, he looks at that thing. He goes, are we really going to get in that tree? And I said, buddy, that thing's in a fork. And unless it gets real windy, we're going to be okay. Yeah. So he was like, man, I don't know. I said, we'll be fine. I'll get a safety harness for you. We'll be all right. So it was where we had to be. I mean, there were other trees around there, but they were crooked and we just couldn't get in them. And anyway, climbed up in it, and where the blowdown had broken out of the other a tree that had blown in there was a hollow, and there was about a 14-pound boar raccoon that was 4 feet away from Lucas's head, and we finally got settled. Anyway, I went way off tangent. That was just a funny setup. But so we hung that day. We got in there about 1 o'clock, and we hung that day, and we saw 8 or 10 deer and had a big buck fight. We could never see it. We could just hear it. And we had 8 or 10 deer, and they all came right through that funnel. You know, different trails. You know, we talk about that. You know, you find, why hunt one trail when you can hunt two? Why hunt two when you can hunt three? Why hunt three when you can hunt four? And this really pinched down 5 into 1. And so it was just a perfect spot. And so the next day we were going to get a little rain about 2 o'clock, and we were going to sit all day. And we got there, and in the morning I had, I think, 3 bucks come by, 7 or 8 does. And, you know, they were coming from around the crop fields and stuff, and the bucks were cruising, and the little rain started about 2 o'clock. And at 2:30, I looked, and one of the scrapes that we had seen, he's in it. The 9-point is in the scrape, and he's working it. And he turns and comes right down the funnel and even closer than I had anticipated. He took the closest trail to us, and I shot him at four steps, quartering two, and just dumped him. It, jugular, junction of the shoulder and spine into the front side lung, and it just dumped him, you know, right there, and that was the end of him. But that was a property or a spot where if it stays the same, you could kill a big deer out of that tree every single year if you hunted the rut. If there was one in there, in that whole travel corridor, if there was a big deer in there, I really believe you could kill him right there every single year.
Yeah, and those finding those spots are so valuable for, like, if you're hunting during the rut, you know.
Yep.
We found a kind of similar spot in Kansas. Kansas, that was my first time ever in Kansas, and that place is I hope I go back every year kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that deer, you guys, I don't know if you're running a little ad or something, but there, you can see it on social media right now. I think you got like a montage of your deer this year, the kill shots, I think.
Yep.
So if you guys hop over to their social Osseo Gear social media, I think you can see that on there. I was gonna, something else I want to talk to you about. We'll keep going on all this stuff, but yeah. What is your, so you hunt out of state an awful lot.
Yeah.
Like, what's your method to your madness whenever you're hunting out of state? Cause I think a lot of guys get intimidated, you know, leaving their home state. Now, it's not as bad as it used to be because there's a lot of information out there, but how do you tackle like an out of state hunt? Do you hunt, like even if it's private or public.
Yeah.
Do you go to, I mean, do you pre-scout? Do you go in the spring?
This time of year, this time of year kills the deer. The Kentucky buck was killed in March. We went in and set that whole place up in March with mock scrapes, got the stand hung. It was another bluff type situation with a funnel. And we got everything set up, got the access. We got all that figured out in March. We went back and cut a camera on in August, the end of August, because their season comes in the first Saturday in September. So we went in glass beans and couldn't find anything, but cut the camera on because that was going to be a pre-rut hunt as well. And everything was set up and ready to go then. So that's an area I've hunted a lot, and so I know it very well. You know, when we fast forward to Kansas, the two properties I hunted on this year, I had never set foot on them. So that was new, but I'm in the whole key to hunting out of state, and you know this very well, and probably everybody listening does, and it sounds like common sense, but it's having reliable folks and reliable intel, right? That you can count on, but because you have a finite amount of time, right? You can't go out there from, you know, August 15th or October 15th to Thanksgiving, or most guys can't. Right. Yeah. You've got maybe a week or 7 days. So if you can make a spring or a summer trip to go out and do a whole bunch of prep work, and then you've got somebody there reliable that's either looking after it, or you know that, you know, if it's a private piece that, you know, not 15 people are going to be on it before you get out there. And then you're able to, you know, go and spend that special time in the rut or whenever it is you want to go hunt it. That's the key. But I mean, like right now, I really want to go hunt the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get too specific on where, but, you know, the Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, they've got a little later rut. You know, they get that November or late December rut into January rut, and they kill some really big deer down there. And so this is exactly how that happened. I talked about that on a podcast. I was like, man, I really want to get something figured out down there. Well, somebody heard that. It was actually Rendell. He called me and said, hey, I got a buddy down there that's a real estate agent. He's a young guy, and I think you might even have met him in Alabama, and you ought to talk to him. And so I had been talking to him probably 10 or 15 times, you know, about deer, about properties. And it's basically all public down there where we would be hunting. But I'm going to try to find maybe a little small 70, 80 acre lease that's near all that public. And then I can do both. But that's what I'm doing right now. I'll be making a trip down there when I get a break from these trade shows. And I'm going to go down there and I'm going to walk all that public. I'm going to see, what do I need? Do I need a, you know, do I need a P-Row? Do I need a canoe, a little boat? Will a four-wheeler work? You know, what do I need to maximize, you know, being able to hunt these areas, or something that'll give me an advantage, right? If I have a Piro or a kayak, you know, is that going to give me an advantage over the guys that are driving in to the parking deck and walking in, you know, anything like that? Or is it a John boat? Do I need to borrow somebody's John boat so I can get in a river and get around? And so it'll give me a little bit of an advantage to hunt those spots. So I really think that out of state hunting, it's done in March and in April before the green up really hits. That's been my experience.
Yeah. You think, like, if a guy, you know, a normal guy that has a, you know, 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, he's going to take a, you know, a 7 day, you got 7 days vacation to spend on an out of state hunt. I mean, would you go to the extent of recommending him taking 2 of those days and spending a long weekend wherever he's planning on going in March and scouting it out? And then
I would, man, even if it take, you know, we talked about the work ethic and the discipline. If it takes taking a Friday off of work and driving to, if you're from South Carolina, whatever, where, if you're from Pennsylvania and you want to go to Kansas or you want to go to Illinois where you can get a tag over the counter, basically. Yeah. Leave Friday at lunch, drive out there. That's a long drive, but you got to do it. Drive out there, get a feel for what you're doing, and then drive all the way back Sunday. So you're ready to go for work, and then you've got your 7 days. And then, you know, if it was me, it would be, I'd probably wait till around the 4th of November. And that would be kind of my go-to time to go spend the next 7 days. But it's all, you know, it can be super weather dependent.
Yeah.
As you very well know, I mean, if you get a big hot spell right in there, it can crush the rut.
Yeah. And that's just the cards that deer hunters are dealt, right? That's just not a lot you can do about that.
Nope.
Unless you got flexibility to just, you know, take your vacation on a limb, then that's different. But
yeah.
Something else that I don't know exactly how this all happened, but you were a big part of the Moon Guide.
Yeah.
Starting off,
yeah.
Weren't you?
Yep. So Jeff Murray, he created the Moon Guide, and okay. He ended up passing away from a real rare blood cancer, I believe. Very, very, very sad. And he and Adam Hayes were buddies, and Jeff's, I guess, widow called Adam, and she had been running the Moon Guide, and it had progressively gotten, you know, less and less and less, because, you know, that's just how a company like that goes, where the principals, you know, kind of a one man band. And she told Adam, she said he always wanted you to have it if anything ever happened to him. And so Adam called me and we ended up buying it. And funny story, man, I bought it in August. And my plan was just to shelf it for the first year because we were already into August.
Yeah.
I had probably 50 people call my Sporting Adventures office and demand it. And I'm like, how are you people getting my number? They were calling Cabela's because that's where it was sold.
Yeah.
And Cabela's was saying, no, she doesn't have it anymore, but we can give you her forwarding information. They would then call her and she would say, well, I've sold it. And this is the guy that bought it. I had a Amish guy that had taken his buggy to a payphone and had called me for the Moon Guide. Said he had had it for 15 years. And I'm like, all right, forget it. So I called the people that printed it. And I said, I need 1500 of them as soon as you can get them done. And they got them to us, and we sold out of them the first year. And eventually I sold my part of the business to Adam, and he's got it full time now. But I think we had grown it back to about 2,500 or 25,000 subscribers when we split. And then of course Adam's taken it and run with it since then and turned it into an app, and it's doing very well.
Yeah. That's super interesting. So, I mean, what is your thoughts on the Moon? And maybe I'm asking the wrong person, but
I have no skin in the game anymore. You know,
that's
I
true.
Used to, and the three biggest bucks I ever shot in Illinois, a 165 and two 180s came on an overhead moon, afternoon hunts when the weather was great. It was real crisp, high pressure, afternoon hunts with overhead moons at like 5 p.m., which is the prime red moon. And the timing was right, too. It was the end of October, first of November. So I think the overhead and underfoot moon definitely have an effect on getting deer up and having them move. But I think weather and pressure trump that tenfold. If you've got a place that gets blown up with pressure, in my opinion, you can throw the moon out the window. If you've got some crazy weather, you know, it's stupid hot. The moon, although Adam shot his fourth or either fifth 200 on a 72 degree day with an overhead moon in Kansas in November. So I can't say it doesn't always work, but you know, you hear all the radio collared stories and I listen to all that. I'm a nerd on all of that. The biologists that radio collar the deer and say that the moon has absolutely nothing to do with movement. To me, I think a lot of those studies are maybe flawed. I think they're looking at moon phases, moon rise, full moon versus the actual overhead and underfoot moon. And how far are they talking about moving? Because a big mature buck, you just need to get him up in daylight. He doesn't have to move very far for you to be able to kill him. So, you can argue it either way. It's an inexpensive tool, and I think guys, should pay. I pay attention to it. I think guys ought to pay attention to it. I'm going to hunt when I can, right? I'm going to go when I can go and when I have time to go. But I pay attention to the moon, and if I've got a big deer that's pretty nocturnal, and I'm trying to kill him before the rut starts, and I've got a great weather day and an overhead moon, I'm going to give it a spin.
Yeah, I've never paid attention to it because I've always had that attitude, like you just were saying, like I like to go hunting, so I don't like let it affect me too much. But this year I kind of paid attention to some apps. Juries have the deer tracker, and I just kind of correlating that with just movement I saw this year. And I've never messed with the moon guide, but I've always, I'm educated on it, and I'm aware of the theory of how it affects deer movement, but
yeah,
all that stuff still, I don't know.
Yeah, and a lot of guys call hocus pocus on it, and that's fine. I mean, it's fine. It's another tool, and I think if guys look at it again, it's not bulletproof. It's not if the moon guy says 8:09 a.m. is going to be the magic time. It doesn't mean get there at 8:05 and leave at 8:15. It's just another thing to pay attention to. Like the barometer and the rising pressure and the cooler than normal temperatures is something to pay attention to.
Yeah. And Dan always, like the way he described it is like it all of that just like moves the needle just a little bit in your favor. So it's always good to have those little things lined up, but it's like none of it's the end all be all. And he talked about it. Funny you said about the pressure, because he always told me the same thing. He's like, I think that stuff works better on a private lease in Illinois or in Iowa, where these deer have 1,000 acres to run on and they're unpressured. They don't get shot until they're 6 years old. He goes, like behind my house in Wisconsin on public land, I don't know if I can correlate anything.
For sure.
Outside of people are either they're getting bumped around or they're not getting bumped around right now,
Yep.
So that's good to know.
Sure.
Here's another thing that I would want to bounce off of you, because if you guys haven't seen Joe's, your YouTube is like Joe Miles, right? Joe Miles.
Yeah, Joe Miles Hunting. That's okay. Right.
I linked it down below, but Joe was talking about some of the testing you've done on equipment. Those are all over on your YouTube channel. I've watched all of them. They're really, really good. So there's some apps now that that you can call a dog tracker in. I think it's called Tracker is the app. And they have collected some data about wounds and what broadheads were used here and there. And I think if I remember right, like the G5 Montech was one that was up there with the amount of deer that weren't recovered. I think that, you know, the rage was up there too. And I have a hard time with that thing. I want to ask you about this, because aren't those probably like the two most popular heads that are sold on the market? Wouldn't it make sense that those would be the highest ones with the amount of wounds, because more people are using them?
Of course it is. And you know, that Rage Broadheads was the number one selling broadhead for like 10 years in a row.
Yeah.
If a dog tracker goes out and he's tracking, you know, let's just say an estate, and 80% of those people are shooting Rage broadheads, because that's how skewed the market was. I mean, they had 80% of the broadhead market. So if 80% of the people, I mean, it's just a law of averages. I have no dog in the fight, and I've tested them. And yes, our tests are backyard warehouse tests. I'm not in a scientific lab. But we've shot a lot of critters too, a lot of deer, a lot of stuff in Africa, a lot of big hogs. You know, this is not anecdotal. I mean, we've shot a ton of stuff, and it's so important to me. I'm not going to shoot something that's going to give me a disadvantage just to prove a point. You know, I understand, you know, what they're saying is that the Montech and the Rage, they get more deer wounded like that, that they aren't able to recover. But man, I don't know.
Well, that's what I don't know. The post was, and I don't really remember who, I don't remember where I saw it or anything, but the post was like a negative thing. It was like, these are the two broadheads that suck, essentially, is what the thing was saying. I'm like, wait a minute here. No, those aren't the two that suck. Those are the ones everybody buys. Like, I think that's what's going on here. Like, if you go to Walmart right now and look on their shelf, there's a G5 Montech hanging there and there's a Rage hanging there.
That's
like,
right.
That's just what any redneck's going to buy to go deer hunting. You know,
it's a law of averages there. And there are differences, like with the Rage, you know, they've got the giant mega cutting one or whatever. It's the extreme. And then, you know, for me, it's that Tri-Pan is the one that I've had a lot of luck with. And we can go down that rabbit hole as to why. But it's a well-built, thick blade mechanical. And of all the ones we've tested, you know, I like that one the most, and have had the most success with it.
Yeah. Do you like and maybe you just said this, I didn't hear you, but do you like the larger, the 2-inch ones, or do you like the inch and a half, or what do you prefer?
I like the Tri-Pan is a titanium ferrule, and then they have 0.039 thick blades. So it's a beefed up blade. Most of mechanicals are in that 0.030, 0.035. And so they're a beefed up, thicker blade, and they've got a real good tip. It's an hypodermic tip. I like their closure. There's no O-rings now. They call it the no collar. So it closes. It's got like a ball and socket joint inside of it. They're super accurate, real quiet. And I shoot the 2-inch ones. And I mean, you can go look at that buck on the Osseo page right now that I shot quartering to. It's a 250-pound Kansas buck, and I shot him quarter in two through the jugular spine and shoulder junction, and it dumped him, and that's with a mechanical broadhead. And that broadhead was in perfect condition when I pried it out of him. So, you know, it's – but I understand, like, if we had Don Higgins right here beside us right now, he would be trying to hit me with a baseball bat.
Yeah, right.
He would say, I'm the dumbest human being on earth. It's just a matter of time before it's going to fail. And he thinks they need to be melted down and made into boat anchors. And I understand where he's coming from. He likes penetration. You know, that's his big thing. And there's no doubt that, you know, that a good, well-built fixed blade is going to penetrate better than my Tri-Pan. So there's no question about that. But there's also, they say those broadheads can't fail, but they absolutely can fail. But it's not in the sense of how you think it would fail. It's going to fail with accuracy, and it's going to fail with noise. Because as hunters, we don't all, and here we go, we're going down a broadhead debate. So sorry.
That's all right.
So as hunters, we're not shooting our bow on a 3D range flat-footed in the backyard, right? We're getting up in saddles and tree stands, and we're having to bend and duck and turn, you know, and to make shots on deer that are critical. And what we're doing when we do that and we change our form is we are torquing our bow. And if you go out in the backyard right now and you've got a fixed blade setup, put a target at 40 yards and torque your bow, torque it, turn your wrist and torque it and shoot it and see how that arrow flies. And then screw on a mechanical and torque it and then shoot the bow and see how it flies and see how much closer you are to the sweet spot with that mechanical than you are with that fixed blade. And as hunters, we are torquing our bows and we're not able to always shoot with perfect form. So the accuracy thing of a mechanical comes into play. Also, a 2-inch cut, right? I can't tell you the number of deer that I have personally tracked tried to help guys that have shot them through the guts with a 1 1/8 or a 1-inch fixed blade head and zero blood. Those guts fill up those holes and there's no blood. Whereas when you got a 2-inch big slap cut going through there, I've shot them through the guts, you know, not made a great shot. And man, you let them lay up for 8 to 12 hours and you go back the next morning and they're dead within 300 yards and you got a blood trail right to them. So, yeah. You know, that's obviously not the ideal best scenario, but I think you have a lot better chance of hitting that area that can still kill the deer as opposed to like the femur. There's only a few angles that you can hit that real leg bone that's still a vital shot. I don't care if you shoot him with a 30-06 or a fixed blade or a mechanical. Most of the times, if you hit that big leg bone, it's not in a kill area. You know, it's in front or it's down below. Scapulas, man, those tripans blow right through scapulas. So that's not an issue. And I've shot them quartering two. I shot a big kudu last year quartering two. With that tripan, you know, that's an 800-pound animal in Africa and just smoked him. So I'm real happy with that. And I think the accuracy, another thing is the noise. You know, we've tested the broadhead flight and those fixed blade heads. If you shoot them right over the decibel reader and then you shoot the mechanical right over the decibel reader at 20 yards, there's a significant amount of noise difference. Mm-hmm. And the deer hear that, you know, they hear that arrow coming. I mean, if you don't believe me, you know, get behind a brick wall and have a guy shoot a bow down that wall. You know, don't peek your head around and
right.
You get hit. But you can hear how loud that arrow actually is downrange, and every little bit of those things can help. And so you know, there's guys out there that. You know, the Ranch Ferry is one of them that's real big on heavy arrows and fixed blade heads. And he's big into that Ashby report. And I understand all that. And I respect all that. And he makes some really good points, especially about bow tuning and having a well-tuned bow. But I disagree with that type setup for whitetail deer.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Yeah. I told you this earlier this year, before season, I talked to you about broadheads and, you know, I've used everything now. Like I've used the, small diameter, 200 grain head, single bevel stuff and killed deer with it. Lost deer with that one too. I've shot the Rage and killed deer with it and lost deer with it too. I'm just like, man, I don't know. There's a lot to unravel for a hunter. And I like talking to you about it. Cause like you've been there and done that. Like you've killed things with a lot of times you start reading things on the internet or you watch a YouTube video. Somebody has not even used these things on animals, you know? So,
I think that's important. Yeah. It's important.
Yeah.
If you're going to listen, you know, if it's, you know, I don't, it doesn't matter what it is. It's got to be a guy that's put it to use, right? Yeah. You know, if it's food plots, well, if it's tree stands, whatever it is.
Yeah. And that's my, well, you know, Dave from Razor Broadheads, I think they sent you some.
Great.
That's why, if I'm going to shoot something out of my compound, I'm going to shoot this, like, they made these because they had the same problem I did. They're single bevels, but they're 1 3/8 cut instead of that 1 1/8.
Right.
And, you know, they're way more devastating than those smaller ones to me. Now with a trad bow, obviously I'm going to shoot these. I'm not, you know, that's what I'm shooting. But I've killed deer with that, with the compound too, and had good blood trail. And with some of the other smaller heads, I've struggled with blood trail with them.
But, and we're splitting hairs, man. At the end of the day, you know, a good fixed blade, and if you want to shoot a heavy arrow, that's fine. I have done a ton of testing on the heavy versus the mid-weight or lighter arrows. And for whitetail, I just don't understand the heavy arrow thing. But look, if you've got confidence in it, you're shooting 30 yards and in with today's modern compounds, man, screw you a muzzy on there, get a heavy arrow, whatever you like, or whatever broadhead it is you like, and get confident. The big thing is not to spend too much time tweaking, man, get proficient with the equipment.
Yeah.
Be able to shoot your bow, be able to shoot a gnat, you know, at 30 yards, you know, that kind of thing is way more important than arguing on forums about what broadhead and arrow setup is the best.
Yeah. And like you said, you made a great point that people do not do is, you know, when we first got on here, you said this is your time of year when you start tinkering with your bow and your arrows and your broadheads and everything and testing. And dude, people wait till September to do that. Most people do. You know what I mean? They do.
And there's some big buck killers, and I will not drop any names. And they are that guy.
I will. Dan Fault.
Dan Andre and Don Higgins. Man, I laugh at him all the time. I'm like, have you shot your bow? And this will be July. He goes, I'm probably going to get it out this weekend and get the dust off of it. I'm like,
you ever,
that's me insane. I'm like, I can't believe it. And they're big buck killers. So there goes my theory about being super proficient. It doesn't matter. You just pull it out in August and off you go.
Right. And it's funny because I can't remember the guy's name. It doesn't matter. But we were at a trad bow shoot. This has been several years ago. And I was with my buddy Alan. And we were shooting with this guy, and he was awful. I mean, me and Alan could shoot circles around him, you know. And I didn't know the guy from Adam, and I didn't know who he was. And we got done shooting, and he's like, "What do you think about that guy?" And I'm like, "Ah, he seems like he needs to work on shooting a little bit, you know." He goes, "That guy's killed every big game animal in North America with a longbow."
Oh my god!
He's like, he has the super slam or whatever that is, you know. I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "He's like, he can't shoot a target to save his life, but you put an animal in front of him, it's dead."
How about that?
So,
yeah.
And he knew I'd react that way, and because he knew I didn't know who he was. But I can't remember the guy's name, though. But if some people may know who it is, there ain't been that many people that done that.
No, not with a longbow. No.
No.
Have not been.
But anyway, so there's that, too. Like, we're sitting here talking about shooting a gnat at 30 yards. This guy couldn't hit the 3D target at 20. So,
right.
You know,
and he's killed everything in North America.
Yeah. Right.
So again, you know, we're splitting major hairs here and do what you like. And I mean, I would say just get real proficient with it and be as lethal of a shot as you can be.
Right. It's just something to tinker with and argue about on social media.
That's right.
All right. One more thing that I called you earlier this year to talk to you about something. We never got back together on it. What do you do with scent control? Do you mess with scent control much?
I mean, I do shower and try and have clean clothes, but it's not something that I'm spraying down and running the ozone machines and all of that. Our deer, I've gotten such an education. I used to do a lot of that. Our deer here in South Carolina are so dadgum spooky and it's hot here. So we're sweating and I went so far down that rabbit hole. In my garage, I had my own washer and dryer for hunting clothes.
Yeah.
And I would wash them. There was never anything scented in any of that. And I would use the dryer sheets, the scent-free soap. I would use rubber gloves, move it from there into a scent-free bag, into a tote, take it to the field, put it all on, run the ozone machines. And if a deer was downwind of me and the thermals were pulling down in the evening, they smelled me, they blew, and they ran. I thought, okay, it's just South Carolina deer. You know, the ones in Illinois are a lot more relaxed, won't have that. So Illinois track, same thing, completely scent-free stuff, sprayed down half a bottle on my boots and my clothes, and I had to walk about half a mile. And I walked down this kind of walking path and turned and walked over to my stand. And I might have told you this story before, but you know, this is at 5:30 in the morning before daylight, getting my stand. 10:30 in the morning, here comes one of those old ancient does with triplet fawns.
Yeah.
Coming through this old cattle pasture, and she hops this little fence and she hits my scent from where I walked in a clear path. And she followed it all the way to the base of my stand and busted me and took off. And that was the time that I said, all right, I mean, it certainly didn't hurt me to go through all of that precaution. It certainly did not hurt me, but it certainly didn't help me either.
Right.
You know, this was 10:30. This was what, 5 hours later that she hit that scent trail and came all the way to the base of my tree. And I had done rubber boots, the whole scent free regime. And it didn't work. That's just one example. And there's many more with that.
Yeah. I've been asking like just random hunters about scent control. It's interesting to hear people's thoughts on it. It's like,
what's yours? Let's hear yours.
I don't do anything, dude. I wear this right here, go out hunting, you know. Yep.
Thermals and wind.
Yeah. I don't know how many years ago it was. It's been a while ago now. I don't think the technology's changed any though, but I bought a scent lock suit with the head net and whatnot. I don't know. It just wasn't for me, man. It was an annoyance for me. And I found myself getting frustrated that I screwed up because I, you know, accidentally touched something that it wasn't my personality.
I've gotten busted in those.
Yeah.
I've worn them again. I went down this, I mean, everything carbon, the layers, the hoods, the booties, the whole, like a spaceship going out to the stand. And
yeah.
I'd still have a South Carolina deer get downwind of me in the evenings with the thermals coming down and smell me and blow and, you know, 50, 60, 70 yards away and they're out of there. They still smell me.
Yeah. And like me and Johnny, I was, you know, Johnny Stewart.
I met him at one of the mobile shows this year.
Okay. Yeah. We shared a camp a couple times this year in Ohio and we got talking about it. Now he's a big fan of he likes to have his face covered up with those scent lock head thing. He goes it makes me feel better. Okay. He's like, all my scent comes out of my head for the most part, so I keep that on my head all the time. So, which surprised me coming from Johnny, to be honest with you. I didn't think he would say that. So it's always interesting to hear what people have to say about it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of your odor does come from your mouth, from your breath.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question about that. Maybe we could get Dr. Fauci on here to tell us how we can wear a face
right.
mask. And,
right, N95 mask in the stands.
That's what we need.
That'll solve all of our problems.
Of course it will.
Oh, God. Yeah. I don't know, man. This world. Yeah. Well, you mentioned that earlier. There's a lot of conspiracies coming true anymore.
There are, and we could have a whole, maybe next time, political discussion.
Oh, we probably need to. Not get on that topic, but
yeah.
All right, Joe, let's answer some questions here.
Okay.
David, he is from South Carolina. He said the South Carolina Low Country bow hunter here. Any tips or tricks on finding mature bucks down here?
Whew, it's tough, man. yeah, there are, and it's amazing and it seems to be universal, but people don't think about it for some reason. Is these smaller towns that have these little developments that maybe go out to a floodplain and they can't develop in that floodplain. I have killed a bunch of mature bucks in South Carolina. You know, some of them, like I've got one right now that I can hear the Gamecock football stadium, the South Carolina football stadium. I can hear the game on Saturday afternoons when I'm hunting. It's that close to town. But we've got a river system that comes through Columbia, and there's a lot of floodplain. And if you can find these places, they're just not hunted. You know, nobody hunts them. And so that and that goes with anywhere that you hunt in anywhere is to find those overlooked spots. And I know that gets beat up all the time, but that's a real prime tactic of mine in South Carolina. I've got, you know, those two places I mentioned earlier that are big pressured hunted spots, but then I have four or five little spots that I've gotten permission in or paid a little small lease fees, and they might only be 15, 18 acres. And there may be an abandoned development that the guy went bankrupt or something like that, the business did, and it's just sitting there. And I'll go in there and find out who's got it and get permission. And man, you go in there and find one, and he has zero clue. He's been in there maybe 4 or 5 years and never encountered any hunting pressure whatsoever. And it's like his little sanctuary. And so that will be my recommendation in South Carolina. I mean, certainly if you can get a 2,000-acre lease and it's all yours, you can do that. But that's not the average person like me that can do stuff like that. So those little small abandoned golf courses, abandoned developments, floodplain where they've developed but they couldn't develop in the floodplain, if you can get permission in those spots, man, those could be killer.
There you go. Chris, man, thanks for being a member for 7 months. He just has his comments Osseo gear. So that's a good question to ask you. Anything new coming down the line or anything, Joe, to people
be looking out for? Yeah, we've got some new stuff coming. We've got a real quiet puffy jacket for an insulated layer. It's going to be really cool. We've got some new gloves coming. We've got a mid-weight windproof, or it really be more of kind of a bridge between mid-season and late-season hoodie that will be 100% windproof and thicker. We've got that coming. We're going to do some adjusting to our packs. Let's see, what else have we got coming? I know there's some more base layers. We had those this year. We've got those obviously coming back. Let's see.
Maddie keeps asking for a woman's line.
Yeah, I know. And I saw something the other day, and I need somebody that's way smarter than me and knows how to digest analytics to look into. Taylor Drury, I think, posted it that 80% of the hunting population is women now or something like that. It was something crazy.
What?
Right. Somebody's going to have to go and look that up. But I thought the women – hunting segment was like maybe half a percent, and maybe it was new hunters. Maybe
it increased by 80% or something.
Yeah. Or the new hunters coming into the hunting space, 80% of them are ladies or something like that. But if anybody out there knows the size of the lady hunting market, I would love to hear that.
Did you hear about the scam these guys had going on? Dan did a show about it on Sunday, and I'm going to get it wrong because I haven't watched the show yet. Dan was just telling me about it. Did you hear about the scam these guys were playing on social media?
Uh-uh.
They were pretending, and I may butcher the story a little bit, but this is the concept. There's a group of guys that were, creating accounts that were women, and they were acting like they were photographers. And they would get on these sites and be like, "Hey, you know, I'm Heather, and I'm a photographer. I want to take pictures of a big whitetail deer." And they would like sucker these guys into telling them where these big whitetails were. When it was freaking some redneck like me on the other end getting information from, and they got in trouble for it. I think like they got
what a great idea.
That's what I told Dana. I'm like, "Holy cow." And that's a real condensed. I mean, there's a lot. I think it was pretty deep, but it was a crazy thing some guys were doing, I guess.
It is.
And said that, like, he thinks a couple of them were on the beast form, and
wow, I mean,
they were going deep into it. So,
dadgum. Just when you think you've heard it all.
Oh yeah,
we got trans hunters out there now.
they were. Well, that wouldn't even. It would be like a fake. I don't know what you would even call that. Just decisive. They weren't.
Yeah.
Tricking. They'd have some pretty girl that they'd use for their photographer girl and get the locations for big bucks.
Unbelievable. That's crazy.
Yeah. David says Andy May liked the Tri-Pan too. That's another person I called when I was looking for a broadhead recommendation this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually had him on our podcast Wednesday, I guess. Well, that was yesterday. And we were talking about that. He's got some new ones he's tried out, and he's a tinkerer, man. He loves.
Oh yeah.
He's got two bows, and he's such a great guy, man.
Oh, he's
and a wealth of knowledge.
He's one of the good ones, man.
For sure.
Yep. And pound for pound, probably one of the best deer hunters alive right now. I mean,
without a doubt.
Pretty unbelievable what he gets done.
For sure.
With his time, you know, the amount of time he has. Josh asked what poundage and draw length are you shooting?
Yep. So I shoot 29 inch draw, 74 pounds. I try to stay between that 72 to 74 pound, and total arrow weights, 470 grains.
All right. So this is kind of to piggyback that comment. Pharrell asked, can you define light arrow, medium arrow, heavy arrow, and would you change setups per situation or run one setup for consistencies?
Yeah, I'd run that one setup for basically everything from elk size down, that 470 grain. And I would call that a moderate, that 450 to, I guess, 500 would be a moderate weight arrow. I think, you know, when you get to 400 and even guys running, you know, IBO or, you know, those type weight arrows like 350, that's getting on the danger side of things, but that would be super light. And then I think when you get over 550, that's when you really start getting into the heavy arrows. But personally, from elk down, I really like that 450 to 470, you know, even up to 500 grains. That's what I would prefer.
And you, I don't know, and I don't know the science behind all of it, but you kind of mentioned to me, I was, didn't you say there's kind of diminishing return after, until you get up to that really heavy stuff, like that you would rather see a 450 grain than a 600 or something like
right.
that.
Right, you're losing the when you go in that middle, that depending on poundage and draw length and all that, the speed you get, but apples to apples, you know, if you're shooting a 450 and you go to a 525, it's the worst of both, right? You're getting the worst amount of trajectory and speed to that animal. And then you're also not getting the quote unquote penetration that you would get out of a 650. So there is a gap there where it's the worst of both worlds. You're not maximizing your penetration that you would on a 650 grain arrow, but you're also not maximizing your speed and trajectory out of say a 450.
Yeah.
So I would rather be a 450 or go all the way up to a 650, but you'll never catch me shooting a 650 grain arrow. Never.
Yeah.
Zero chance.
And I guess it depends on your draw weight and
length. Oh, yeah. Yeah. All
gap is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All of that. I mean, if you're shooting 80 pounds and you got a 30 inch draw and you're shooting a 550 grain arrow at 300 feet per second, I mean, you've got the same trajectory that I've got.
Right.
You know, so yeah, you've got to look at all of it. You just can't look at one part of it.
Yep. Buck Slayer asked if you've been on Whitetail Cribs, and I think you have, haven't you?
Yes. There is an episode on Whitetail Cribs. Yep. The Exodus Boys. I like those guys. They're super
nice. Yeah, they're good guys. They'll be at, are you coming to Pennsylvania at all?
Well, yeah, I'll be at Harrisburg for 7 days.
Okay. Well, I think they'll be there. They don't go to very many shows, but I think they do go to that one.
Yeah, that's a long one.
All right. David asked, Joe, are you still chasing that big one in South Carolina that won't come out of the big cut down?
You are 100% David, and that thing made a fool out of me this year, and he is still alive. I got a picture of him right before we had our big flood. He is still alive, still in there, and hopefully next year. We could run down that tangent real quick, but I'm going to actually go create some funnels for that sucker. I'm going to go in there and hinge cut some stuff. I've got some sawtooths that start dropping in August. They drop early, middle to end of August. And I'm going to hinge cut some stuff coming out of that cutover and see if I can't force him to come through a gap to go to those sawtooths. So that's a project I got on my list to try and do. But, man, he's been a thorn in my side.
There's always one of them.
Golly, I know. There is.
I wanted to ask you one more question. We're done with the questions on the chat there, unless more come in here. But how did you get started in the Team 200 and all that stuff and meeting those guys?
Yeah, so I had a buddy from Illinois that was good friends with Stan Potts. And I don't know if you remember. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Old
Stan. I loved watching that guy growing up.
Yeah, he was passionate, man.
Yeah.
He still is. He still hunts.
Give me a second, folks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was passionate, to say the least.
I forgot about him, man.
Yeah. But anyway, he was friends with Tom Miranda.
Okay.
And so basically how all that went down is I'd been killing some big deer in Illinois, and they started up the Matthews Dominant Buck Show. Miranda and Potts asked me if I wanted to be a part of that show. And so Adam was a part of that. Adam Hayes, Adam Crumrin, Chris Seymour, the Baker Boys. It was a good group of guys. We had a great group of guys. And so got to be friends with them. And, you know, the thing about those TV shows back in the day is there's no growth in the show, right? You've got the owner. He gets all the sponsorship dollars, and then he's got the guys producing the content from him, and you get kicked some product, and you get kicked maybe a little small hunt budget, but the guy making all the cheese is the man at the top, and it's not his fault. You know, that there's not going to be a secretary and then a operations manager and then a vice president. So there's no room for growth. So after three years of that, you know, Adam and I started talking, and he's like, man, I got an idea for a show. And we were actually hunting in Alberta together. And we put that whole thing together on that hunt. And then we got home. We started it.
Gotcha. Okay. That's interesting. I didn't know. Just was wondering.
Yep.
Dan has some funny stories about Stan Potts. He said he's a super good guy.
He is.
And he loved hanging out with him. It was something along the lines of they were hunting with Jackie Bushman at some hunt. You know, those guys always threw big hunts or something. They invited Dan, and somebody was making fun of Dan for something. I don't know what it was. If it was the size of the buck he shot while they were on the trip or something. Anyways, Stan was trying to make him feel better, and told him, like, at least they're not making fun of you for being as ugly as I am, and going on and on and on about all this stuff. He said he was a real good-hearted guy. So
yeah, he is. He's full of charisma, great personality. You know, life of the party guy. A lot of fun to be in camp with.
Good guy. Yep. David asked if you have any more podcasts with Bobby. Really interested in learning more about these real funnels.
Yep. So we probably will do. Bobby's kind of gotten out of the whole podcast thing, but he and I are doing two courses in March up at his place. And I announced it on our podcast, and we were only going to do one, and that one filled up like overnight just from my little podcast. And so I think there are two or three spots still available in that first date or the second date of that course. And it's a chance to get in the woods with Bobby Worthington and walk, and not a sales pitch. I mean, the guy asked about Bobby Worthington, but if anybody would be interested in that, I know there are like two, maybe three spots left, and it's at Bobby's home farm. And he's in as good a whitetail hunter as walking in North America, especially big woods and rut funnels. And so I'm excited about going up there and being with him. And it'll be like a meet and greet at 5 o'clock in the evening, have dinner. The next morning will be in a classroom for about half the day, then lunch, then out in the field. And then the next day will be a full in the field day, wrapping up at 5. So if anybody is interested in that, they can email me at Osseo, joe@osseogear.com, or even call. Didn't mean to go on a big sales pitch there, Josh, but
no, that's all right. Where's it located, Joe? Where's it?
It's in Pikeville, Tennessee. Kind of near Chattanooga, I think, south or either north. It's near Chattanooga, but so it near Nashville. It's like an hour away from Nashville.
And it's in March.
It's in March. Yeah, the two dates. I think the 8th through the 10th, and then the following weekend, like the 15th through the 17th, I think are the dates.
There you go, Joe. We've been on here for about an hour and 20 minutes, so we can let you go. But before you go, give us a sales pitch. I linked some of your guys' stuff in the description. And obviously you guys know that Osseo is always down there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Osseo gear, it's different, you know, it's made for whitetail tree stand bow hunters. The pattern is made after the great horn owl, and it just blends in super well. You know, to me, obviously I'm biased. It's the best tree stand camo pattern across the whitetail range. We've basically tested it everywhere, and it really is a pattern that's going to blend well, you know, into trees. If you're going out elk hunting in the West, you know, that's not the pattern for you. And then, you know, we've got really high end fabrics and windproof liners and insulations to keep you warm and able to stay in the tree. And then early season stuff, you know, we're founded here in South Carolina. You know, our early season stuff with the way we have the vents and the fabrics that we use that keep you cool for early season hunting. I think we probably do a better job of that than about anybody out there. Our early season hoodie and early season pants with that mesh crotch and those vents and that pocket system really keeps you cool. And we've got, I mean, one of the things that I think we do different too, and I'll wrap this up, is we've got a lifetime warranty. So it literally, if you buy a pair of our bibs or pants or whatever, and you're climbing a barbed wire fence 5 years from now and you hang it up on there and it's 100% your fault, it rips the pants, we'll either replace them or get them repaired. So that's something that we have that I'm not sure that other companies offer. We want to stand behind it.
Yeah. The last two Christmases I've been buying my dad hunting clothes from Osseo, because he's never really had real nice hunting stuff. I mean, clothing wise, you know, he's just always bought whatever. And he's been, I bought him the Sherpa line bibs and jacket, and for this last Christmas, and man, he's like, for as light as this stuff is, this is warm. And he's worn a couple times, you know. And then we were in Nebraska, and it's the first time I bought him like an early season setup. And the first time he'd used like the, you know, you guys got the zipper down the vents on the side and stuff. He was all about it. So
yeah,
that's coming from a guy that doesn't have any skin in the game or anything. He was praising it. So
well, Dan, I think even Dan sent me a picture with him wrapped up in our bibs and jacket, our latest stuff, and he said, "Man, this stuff's warm. I really like it." So
he mentioned
a great testimonial to get.
Yeah, he was on the show last week, and he mentioned it. He's like, "Man, I wore that stuff, and I think they went up to the UP and hunted." Wow. And he wore it up there, so it's cold up there.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, if you guys are you guys have your trade shows also posted on your social media. I know
we do. We got a whole bunch of them from all over, all the major ones. You know, we'll be in Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, obviously Harrisburg. I think we go to Pennsylvania twice, doing two of the TAC events. But yeah, they're all on the website, and we will have show specials at all of those. And obviously, you know, I think you can get a discount through you, Josh, with your podcast. So
yeah,
we really appreciate it, guys. We thank you for your support there, and means a lot to us. You know, having a business is a passion. It's so awesome seeing it come from an idea to guys, you know, wearing it and being successful in it. So thank you all very much.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Can people come to South Carolina there and actually go to like a storefront, or you guys just have? Okay.
Yeah, we do. We're just finishing it up. We just actually we outgrew our first space and moved into a bigger warehouse, and the front of it has a showroom, and it is, people could come in right now and shop. And so, yeah, it's in Columbia, South Carolina. So if anybody's rolling through there and wants to come in and talk hunting or just see the stuff, come on. We'd love to have you.
Yeah, David was asking that. That was a good question. And then also go follow the Mission Whitetail podcast. You didn't mention that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do you enjoy doing the podcast?
I do, man. I learn so much.
Yeah.
You know, we have guys on like Andy and Bobby, like the gentleman was mentioning. And you know, I learn a ton. And I feel like I'm able to ask questions, you know, just like you. You know, you're able to ask questions because you've been there and done it. And there's things that can help us all get better with the right questions. And so I think that's a thing that I enjoy doing, is asking, you know, real specific questions. And so that, I think you can get some information out of these guys that have done it forever.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. All right, everybody. Thanks for getting on tonight. And we will talk to you all next week. See you.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you, Josh. Had a great time.